You mentioned the Black Panther movement in the 60s, and I was just curious whether you thought that something along the lines of the kind of self-sufficiency, you know, the Oakland breakfasts and those types of things would be viable in any way today, maybe without the militancy aspect of that. In other words, whether blacks need those types of groups today or whether those types of groups would be possible today.
Well, I don't think we certainly don't need that kind of one of the kinds of, and maybe this is what you're one of the kinds of groups that usually emerge when an oppressed people come into freedom and get that shock, that real hit, you know, like an electric shock, invariably, and pops up some group that basically takes their identity, the identity that was once used against them, in this case, our race, our blackness, and makes a sort of, and tries to seek power through that identity. That's, I think, exactly what we see now in the Middle East and with Islamic extremism. All of a sudden, there's this people in this extremist in the Middle East looking for power through identity, through nothing but being a more pure Muslim than the next guy. Exactly the same thing as what we saw in the 60s. The Panthers were one example. The cultural nationalists were another, where we're going to all of a sudden pursue power through blackness. We're going to be what? I guess really black. Well, what does black do? Does it build a car, or is it no engineering, or you begin to see it's an identity that these groups are compensating for that inner sense that, God, we don't know what to do with freedom. We don't have the cultural capital. We don't have the education. So rather than face that, it's painful to face. It's not easy. I have a lot of sympathy. Then we shoot off these identity groups that tell us, well, the real way to solve these problems is just to be blacker or to be more extreme in your Islamic devotion. Be willing to kill. Be willing to kill yourself. And that's how we will prevail. We can't make the guns we shoot. The entire GNP of the Middle East, when you take oil out of it, is less than that of Finland. There's a good deal of backwardness, underdevelopment. That's where you see these kinds of groups like the Black Panthers emerge. So they, you know, try to do something, have a little camouflage, where they may have a breakfast program or something, as if breakfast is really a serious problem for black Americans. And if we just give these little kids breakfast, we'll overcome. So there, again, the use of identity as power. And so we truly, I don't think, need those kinds of groups. Hope we don't see them come around again.
The question of self-help.
Well, if it was really self-help.
Yeah.
If again, self-help is usually, it has to be based in the individual. You were talking about the individual earlier. I like that very much. Ralph Ellison said it beautifully. The group is the gift of its individuals. If I develop myself and pursue my dreams in life and become what I can become, then that becomes the gift I make to the group. And other people in the group have to do the same thing. If we're going to just get together and be black and use the word self-help, then obviously that doesn't get us very far. Yes, sir.
I am second guessing that gentleman, and I look at the Panthers phenomenon partly as a self-defense kind of mechanism. And the Panthers aside, though, I lived in Leavenworth, Kansas. And during the 30s, the Ku Klux Klan, many of them from Missouri, would ride through parts of Leavenworth, and they would shoot into homes that were owned by black people. And it wasn't until the black people started shooting back that stopped.
Good.
And so I'm looking at the Panthers. I think they got sidetracked with drugs and other kinds of problems. But I think the idea of protecting yourself is very, very important. And before, let's say, the Johnson administration, well, even before or around in the 50s, there were these ideas that blacks were almost helpless in face of white power. And I think mm-hmm. you wrote about Emmett Till as an example in mm-hmm. 1955.
Yes.
Where you have no power to defend That's right. yourself. And yet, once you get the power, a lot of the things that the oppressor or various people did with impunity no longer occur.
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. And one of my personal heroes, and maybe at the very top of the list in Black America, is Nat Turner, who said, "No." And took things into his own hands and had one of the biggest slave rebellions in American history. I wish there had been more slave rebellions. I wish there had been so many that slavery had become an impractical institution to sustain. It's painful. But to answer your question about the Panthers, the problem there is that nobody was shooting into the homes of black people in Oakland. There was no need for a militaristic defense at that particular time in history. There probably was at an earlier time, and I'm very proud of the people who defended themselves, and certainly self-defense is everyone's right. But my problem with the Panthers is it was more of a posture. It was when we were free, that's when they picked up the gun. Let me say this. I write about this in the book. You may notice that right in around 1965, that's when the really big race riots began to start. The first one was in Los Angeles, huge riot, burnt down major parts of that city, killed I don't know how many people. Then we began to have one after the other all the way through the late 60s. Interestingly, the race riots, the Black Panthers, the cultural nationalists, the Black Power movement and all of its many different manifestations began at precisely the moment white guilt started. Right when whites, from the president on down, acknowledged what they'd done wrong. Why was it in 1961, 62, there were no race riots, there were no Black Panthers? When we were in real segregation, in what I call the age of racism, where white supremacy had its authority, we didn't do that. We didn't riot very often or rebel very often because we knew we would be instantly put down. So the fact that we finally had white guilt, whites back on their heels, having to prove that they were not racist, was an opportunity to finally become militant and finally become carry guns and start shootouts with the pigs and all that sort of thing. Well, you know, it was a little late. It was a little late then. Yes, sir?
You know, there's just so much I want to say. thank you. I don't know if I need this. Okay, is that better? Yeah. Mostly because, you know, as a grad student, I worked in war and poverty, albeit under Nixon, and most of the poverty programs were run by whites, serving whites. And I worked in one of those breakfast programs in North Philly, and I remember mostly serving kids pancakes. I was a grad student. But that's neither here nor there. Now just travel.
I worked in four of them myself, four different ones.
Good. I think we're contemporaries.
Yeah.
If you were to transport yourself to Marcus Bookstore, which is in West Oakland, mostly black audience, okay?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you've ever been there or...
I've been to many black bookstores.
Okay. Okay. And then speaking before a black audience. And I talked to you about that book, Contract with Black America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Covenant. I'm sorry. The Covenant with Black America. And I've been to those rallies. And,
mm-hmm.
and as I listen to them, I never hear anything about white guilt, white mm-hmm. racism. In fact, I never hear much about white folks in that book. Most of it seems to be about self-help. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you, this from your perspective, mm-hmm. is there anything good that you can say that's going on in black America that you can tell these folks?
Mm-hmm.
Something that folks are doing good that you like
mm-hmm.
and that you would support? And just finally, what do you think the role is for the 75% of black folks in order to who are not poor, in order to uplift the 25% who are?
Uh-huh.
And you know, those people who work with, you know, the age issue yeah. in the black community,
mm-hmm.
the incarceration issue, the health issues, all those things which may not have anything directly to do with white racism, and people aren't even talking about white guilt.
Mm-hmm. Let me try to parse those questions out. Let me take the, remind me if I, I believe you will. The first one is a good question, and you're asking it very sincerely about, is there something good? What's good? What's good that's going on in black America? And you're talking about the Tavis Smiley, the big thing he has every year where he brings together all sorts of black leaders and big crowds and so forth. You know, I think I have no doubt we'll be better off when we don't do that anymore, when we don't feel the need to do that. We sort of continue to have this idea that there's something in our race that really truly matters and that's going to take us forward. And my fundamental difference with them is, as proud as I am and have written a lot about black culture and the genius of it, really, which through which we are all here today. If there wasn't a real genius in black American culture, we would never have made it into the 19th century. But we haven't yet found our way in freedom, it seems to me. And I think one of the problems is we keep. I'm going to see Tavis Smiley next week, and I'm going to have hopefully have this discussion with him. That
you,
I think it's his TV show.
Radio for an hour. That's why I want to.
Okay. Well, maybe it'll be that too. I don't have to look at the schedule. But. As nice as the fellow feeling is in those occasions, there's this warm sort of camaraderie, a fellow feeling that I think is wonderful and good. But the modern world really asks us to be individuals. It really requires it only knows how to respond to individuals who have something to offer to it in some way or other. You know, some skill, some talent, some maybe just hard work. It can be any number of things. But race is not something does whiteness, you know, if whites are all unified and they get together and they work as individuals. And they do well or do poorly as individuals. It's going to be that way for us. And it's not good to hold out, and this is where I have a little qualm with Brother Tavis. It's not good to hold out this illusion of group unity as a means forward. It isn't. It's not a means forward. It doesn't do math. It doesn't make money. It doesn't invent things. It doesn't. Individuals do those things.
A reminder, my question was,
What did you see?
Not as good. Okay.
Good,
well,
in Black America.
All right, I'm gonna I'm working here. What I see is that there are many blacks that I run into all the time, many, and I mean, I don't know if I'd name a percentage, but certainly it makes me feel that a large percentage of Black America is moving away from this. This idea of manipulating white guilt as the way forward. Many blacks that I meet all over the country who I get letters from, who proud people who are going ahead with their lives in an undramatic way, but are doing well and want you know this other idea to feel exhausted with it. Feel tired with it. So that's something I see as really good. I think, certainly I encourage that and you're free. Think about what you want in life. Have a dream. Have a real dream. Have a passion in your heart. Something you want to do. You want to offer to the world. Whatever it might be, and in that dream will be your contribution to your race. So there are a lot of black people like that, and that's good. Yes, ma'am.
I really enjoyed your speech a lot. Do you go to high schools, like to minority high schools, and talk to the students before they graduate? I think that would help them a lot. I think.
Mm-hmm. I do that sometimes. Yeah, I do. Yes. I enjoy that. Uh-huh. There's a lot of high schools out there, though. Yes, sir? Yes.
I disagree with you on the effectiveness of what you call white guilt. Guilt is a good thing, incidentally. It generally fixes problems.
If it's real guilt.
Yeah. But okay. But now, let me share my own personal experience with you.
Well, I want you to ask me a question now, because okay, there are a lot of people question. Who want to ask.
All right. The question is, on an individual, on a micro level, I'm looking for a job.
Yes.
Do you believe that if I am on the short list, started with 20, now it's down to 4, and there's one black guy myself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that I have a chance?
Oh, God, today you're a shoo-in.
I disagree with that 100%.
Today you'd be a shoo-in.
No, not really.
Oh, yeah.
Let me tell you why.
Today you'd be hired and they'd worry about the others.
I've been in a situation like that and I disagree, and I'll tell you why.
Well, wait a minute. Let me, because what you're asking me is the following. You're saying, isn't racism still a problem? That's what you're asking.
No, I'm
what
not
I'm saying,
that
what
question.
I'm saying is, let me answer quick because you're saying there's still barriers out there to you as a black. What I'm trying to communicate is that yes, that might be true. What the example you give might be true. There might be circumstances where you run into some racism. I have run into some racism. I'm sure I will again, but. What I'm saying is there are other jobs. There are other opportunities. And if you let the fact that you might possibly in a hypothetical situation be discriminated against by someone somewhere sometime stop your life, you have no one to blame but yourself.
Are you suggesting that I stop my life?
No, I don't know anything about your life, and so don't take anything I say personally. I'm talking in the abstract. I'm saying racism is not a barrier to the dream that you have here in your heart. You have a dream. If you have one, racism's not going to stop you.
Absolutely, and I understand that. That's why I'm in business for myself. However, there is you're not dealing with the issue. The issue is white guilt. And I don't think that white guilt is as effective as you make it out to be.
Let me clarify that. Okay. Remember this now.
Yeah.
I said And I know it's a lot to absorb in a lecture because it's kind of a little bit abstract. You should buy the book. But white guilt is not a guilt of conscience. It's not a feeling of guilt, of remorse over something that you did wrong. White guilt is a manipulation. Good power to you. The fact that whites are stigmatized and therefore have to dissociate, all have to find ways to prove that they're not, and so therefore come up with really all these very bad policies that don't help blacks. That's all I'm saying white guilt is.
Could I add one little thing? Economists have pointed out that the reason why people are in business is because they want to attract as many customers to make as much money in whatever that field might be. So it's in their rational self-interest to employ people who have the best skills and can contribute to that enterprise the best. And in keeping with what Shelby is saying, is that that means that anyone should be thinking in terms of what kind of skills and what kind of advantages can I bring to that possible job or opportunity, or if you're in business, you're trying to attract customers. In other words, I think the confusion often is if someone is not being given an opportunity, is it because they are not competitive, because they haven't developed those skills and they're not showing that I am better, or is it because of race? Now, it certainly is a case people will use racism as an excuse, but I think that when you individualize the relationships, which is what we're talking about in a free system, is that it comes down to why are you better in that market than the other people? And if you see someone else beating you out, by golly, figure out what it is you can do to beat that person out and be more productive. And I think that's a very important thing for anyone to learn.
I can't say that's so true. I mean, one of the most painful things about that again, about this experience of freedom that came to us is this understanding of how competitive you have to be. Ooh, I didn't really understand that. You have to be excellent at something. You have to pursue something so that you can compete. You can say, well, he's got a skill level there, but mine is there. And I can prove it, and that's why you have to hire me, and that's why you have to buy my product, whatever. The burden of freedom, as Sartre used the term, the burden of freedom is so demanding, asks so much of the individual. It asks us to be so responsible in so many ways, and that's one of the reasons we shy away from it. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Hello.
Oh,
sorry. The rapper say I got the mic.
Oh. I have to crawl around on my knees, so okay. I'll get to you.
Okay. Two-part question. Try to be a relevant question. Show I was listening. You mentioned during your speech, you mentioned two things that I want to respond to. One is the individual. Second thing is not being ready for freedom. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, about the not being ready for freedom part and how to approach the world outside of a repression-oppression framework, solely in a repression-oppression framework. And if you're familiar with the work of Albert Murray and if you think his work can contribute to that, that's number one. That's one question. The first question is the individual.
Albert Murray?
Yes.
The jazz, yeah.
Yeah, the author. Yes, he wrote Omni-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is you spoke about the individual, and I think I want you to respond to how counter that acts or works against the deeply Judeo-Christian kind of group mentality that African Americans have, the whole delivering from bondage or lost people. I mean, it's deeply rooted in Judeo-Christian construct, and the individual. I think is going to take some sorting out to kind of process through that to get to the individual. So I want you to speak on those two things.
Well, let me take the last first. I want to make clear here when I talk about the individuals and the group, I'm not saying the two are mutually exclusive, that you can have no group identity and you must be an isolated individual. I take a great deal of strength from my group identity. It is really a part of me, of my individuality. I have learned so much and so many things. I can't imagine myself without frankly, the riches that have come to me by my group identity. And yet that in no way spares me from having to be responsible as an individual and do something, pursue a dream. And again, oppression makes for, when you're segregated, that makes for a lot of unity. you're going to be unified as we leave oppression, as segregation fades away, as we come into the free world. Group boundaries. It is yet to be seen whether one of the great challenges among Jews today, the fact that so many Jews intermarry. I think the rate is somewhere 60% of Jews marry people who aren't Jewish, or somewhere near that. Some rabbis call this a second Holocaust, because they're losing so many, or feel like as though, and they're trying to find all kind of ways to keep people with a sense of identity. Well, why is that the case? The case is because Jews are free in America. They're not pushed into a ghetto. There's no imposed unity anymore. And so the freedom diffuses identity. It diffuses group identity. It's going to diffuse the black identity too. Thank God. Because the other alternative, we could have a good black identity if we want to go back into segregation. And I don't want that. So we're going to be diffused too. Our interracial marriage rates are going up. Have doubled and quadrupled, excuse me, in the last 15 years. So because we have more freedom, we can, and people will pursue their own lives as they will. So, we did have talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition and so forth. Certainly we had a strong group identity. We still do, but as time goes on, we're going to slip. And I forgot what the first part of that. Being ready for freedom. Yes. Yes. That's right. Freedom comes to as a shock to all groups. The reason it causes terror, it causes fear, and we start to define ourselves in bad faith and start to say there's racism everywhere so that we don't have to be free, is because freedom asks so much of the individual. Just ask almost a ridiculous amount from the individual. So much responsibility and self-direction and self-governance. I get tired of it, frankly. But I have no option. Yes, ma'am.
Within the context of white guilt, what are the solutions that you're seeing? Because so many policies are still coming out of that yes. mode that are negatively impacting people of color, i.e. the immigration issues and all that.
Yes.
What is your message to white America?
Thank you. Again, I think I talked about the fact that I think white America has made an enormous, astounding. When I grew up in segregation, you could never have convinced me that whites would have come as far as they have today. I would not have believed that. Yet they have. And I think that one thing they have to do is have some moral confidence in themselves and say, look, I may not understand every nuance of black culture. I may not, you know, I may make a faux pas here and there, but damn it, I mean well. And I don't have an animus toward a race. And so therefore, if you can accept that in yourself, then you're not going to say, well, I've got to have a diversity, some sort of silly diversity scheme where I have all kinds of double standards and all the problems that come with racial preference. I don't have to have that in order to prove. In fact, I can go to black people and say, look, you might think about making it in freedom this way. This is how people, one of the real problems we have as blacks today is because whites are so terrified of speaking to us, because they think that we'll, and telling us what they honestly think, because they think we'll call them a racist, The result is we live in a bubble. We don't get information from whites about how to do well in freedom. They don't tell us. They would never tell. You know, one of the things that I harp on all the time is child rearing in Black America. Boy, we have to do a better job in rearing our children, in making sure that they come in the world well loved, read to, taught their colors, their numbers, talked to, treated with respect, their minds developed from infancy on, so that when they finally do go to school, that they're really, I pound that. You won't hear any white people say that. Because they feel that if they say it, they're going to instantly be seen as racist. So we don't get that feedback. And if I say it, you know, they'll call me an Uncle Tom, but then I'm used to that. But one of the things I always say to white people is when you're at home at night around your kitchen table, when you say, you know, if black people would just do this. I remember a white woman came up to me about a couple of months ago, and she came up just humbly, and, you know, she was like whispering. And she said, I'm just so afraid to say this. I know it's not my place to say this. And I just hope you won't think badly of me, but I think it would be so helpful if blacks learned to speak better. Oh, no. She's right. And we need to hear that. We need to get that feedback. I'm not going to hire somebody to work for me who is speaking like a rapper. I want someone to have a command of standard American English. We should be insisting on that. Well, whites don't say it. And so one of the things that they have to do, as difficult as it is be more courageous and be more honest with us. Rather than hiding behind all these policies, coming up with another sort of gimcrack scheme to whatever. A lawyer talked to me this morning, and isn't it wonderful that we have in our law firm, we have a diversity program, and we want to hire more black. No, it's not wonderful. It would be wonderful if blacks were pounding down your door. Why is it wonderful why should you do it? Why should you take responsibility? Where are the blacks? They ought to be pounding your door down to get in that law firm. That's what makes me sad. Yes?
Have you heard from...
Jones.
Yes, I know.
I thought I had a pretty loud voice.
The good Reverend?
Have you heard from members of the black establishment types, the Angela Davises, the Jesse Jacksons? Have you heard from any of those folks since you wrote this book? and if you have, can you share it with us?
I have over the years had conversations with all those people, with Jesse Jackson, with Al Sharpton, who is a very charming man. I can't think of a better dinner partner than Reverend Al. And yet, yes, we profoundly disagree. We just disagree. And I was going to, Jesse wanted me to write something with him at one point, and we didn't get too far. But the civil rights establishment, which has rigidified, gotten worse. Jesse Jackson used to be when back in the early 70s, I used to go to his Operation Push in Chicago, and he was talking about turning the TV off at home and keeping the family together and insisting on homework and all and reading and had a book rental program and all. He was great. And he says none of that now. And he gets so much money and attention from manipulating white guilt. And he's so good at it. I mean, he's a virtuoso, of it. He has gotten billions of dollars from American corporations, who he threatens to stigmatize if they don't pay up. And when you're rewarding somebody with billions of dollars, it's hard to break that habit. So, you know, he's a good example of where white guilt really is a dangerous thing. I think this young lady had her hand up for a little bit.
I was just wondering if you honestly believe without affirmative action that students, minorities, including women, would honestly be able to compete equally for positions in schools, jobs.
Absolutely. In fact, I don't think they'll ever be able to really compete equally until we get rid of affirmative action and stop. Again, it's this idea. Look at the thinking behind affirmative action. America is an evil. It is still to this day determined to be racist. Universities, which we all know to be the most liberal pockets in American life, have not practiced racial discrimination or gender discrimination in 60 years. They do the opposite. They do discriminate against Asians. Asians really get a raw deal from affirmative action. So I have no doubt that we would have done, we would do better without it, because we would be more competitive. Both women and minorities would be more competitive. If you say, if the university says, here's a standard. We don't care who you are. This is the standard. You never have a perfect meritocracy, but as close to that as you can get. Then we all we compete. If we don't get in that school, we get in another school, and we can then walk around honorably with our honor, without thinking I can't make it if there's not paternalism. What a cruel thing to do to women and minorities, to tell them that they can't, that they're inferior, they can't compete. It's this, you know, it really burns me up. We take as I said earlier, the talented 10th, the brightest, most educated blacks, minorities, women, and you say you cannot compete with white. Well, that's the group that ought to be competing. That's black people ought to be demanding that you let our best compete with all other groups. And that's how we're going to overcome through excellence. We're going to beat you. We're not gonna beg. We're gonna beat you. You have to get up early to compete with us. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Could I add one quick thing that might also put this a little in perspective? After the Civil War in Southern states, emancipated blacks were going into the workplace. They were essentially breaking into white markets. In many states, they're intermarrying and so on and so forth. They were on their own breaking down the stereotypes when people were racist. And the only way that they could be stopped was Jim Crow laws. Now, Jim Crow was needed to stop competition. And that's why apartheid was started. So that's a very important thing to keep in mind, is that freedom can prevail if people pursue it. And the thing that has stopped it historically has been coercion.
Yes, that's so true. White guilt has bred this idea in black America that we're weak, that we can't compete. In the year 1895, there were 5 high schools in the city of Washington, D.C. The second best high school was Dunbar, was all black. Can you imagine that today? An all-black high school being better than 3 white high schools? We see, when you ask people to compete, they compete. They do well. When you just keep hammering the message that you can't make it if you don't get some little gimcrack paternalism from the system, you defeat women, you defeat minorities, and you elevate the white male, and you make him like a god, you make him unbeatable. And he's the only one who walks around with his full pride and his honor. And when we get in a pinch, we want to go back to him again. So you repeat the patterns of oppression when you practice affirmative action. Yes, sir. You've had your hand up for a long time.
When we look around at American culture, it's easy to spot flaws and shortcomings. but we have certainly an enormous amount of to be proud of. And I think your comments about America's efforts to turn back racism is just one example. There's, mm-hmm. there's a tremendous amount to be very proud of. And in the conservative community, I guess we refer to that as American exceptionalism. But when we talk to liberals, it looks more like white supremacy. I wonder how you would distinguish between the two.
Well, you're absolutely right. I wrote a piece not long ago talking about that, where our supremacy, our exceptionalism, because of white guilt, because we're stigmatized as a white imperialistic racist power, our supremacy looks like white supremacy. It isn't. It doesn't have anything to do with white supremacy. But people can easily, the French can say we're imperialist pigs and our president is a cowboy. The American left loves to wield the stigma on the anti-Americanism of the American left. It's that we're, you know, really deep down, America is still that racist, greedy, evil society. And we want to go to Iraq just to beat up on those brown people and take their resources and so forth. Well, you know, I don't want to argue the war in Iraq. It's reasonable people can reasonably disagree, but I don't think we went there to do that. We may have gone there for dumber reasons, but we did not do that. It was not a deep racist impulse in American society that led us to do that. And we ought to stop paying attention, taking people seriously who say that. They ought to be ashamed of themselves. They're just calling names. They're just wielding the stigma. As I said in this piece, there's very little difference between in anti-Americanism between Jacques Chirac in France and Al Sharpton in America. They both do the same thing. They both call us racist, imperialist pigs. And they both get a lot of power as a result of that. But it's again, white guilt, the use of a stigma to contain this great power that America is.
One more question.
Okay. Yes, sir?
Would you say something about the fact that we have the problem of black men killing black men? I, as a black man, I don't like being an endangered species. But also in this country, we also have the problem of white men killing white women. Can you say something about something that could be done to stop this happening?
Let me see. Let me try here. You know, you're right. The murder rate, black on black crime, is terrible. 55% of federal prisoners today are black. We're only 11% of the population. We've got this exorbitant crime. A lot of that has to do with the breakdown of family that I've been talking about. The father's not being in the home, so that the young boy does not get the kind of discipline, the sort of development of a superego, a sense of responsibility, a sense of limitation. And so he finds that in prison after he's done something terrible. And that then becomes almost a kind of norm, a kind of prison becomes a kind of rite of passage that the family ought to be. You know, your father, my father did that to me, said, you will go this far and no further. And you'll have to accept that. So I didn't have to go to prison to get that kind of a response from the world. But many young black men today who don't have a male, in their lives who's teaching them that then, end up breaking the law, killing each other as though life means nothing, as though it's cheap. It's a part again of what we were talking about earlier. This decline that set in when we began to rely on white guilt. That's right. Viacom and what is it? What, 80% of all hip hop music is bought by whites, by white males. But it's a product that we sell our despair, our pain. That we manifest in rap, we sell it to the larger society. Thank you very, very much.